It has been estimated that over the course of the 20th century, genocide and mass murder has killed an estimated 60 million people, men, women, and children. That's more than were killed on all of the battlefields in all of the wars fought between 1900 and 2000. And in the opening years of this century, we are not doing any better. Millions more have been added to that list, which brings you to the question, why does this happen? How does genocide begin, and can it be eradicated? This morning, in this hour of the show, we will be talking with Barbara Colarosa. She is an internationally recognized speaker and author in the areas of parenting and teaching and school discipline, nonviolent conflict resolution. She's written a lot about bullying, and she also has had a long interest in this particular problem that we're talking about here this morning, genocide. And in fact, in a newly published book, she makes the argument that the behavior cycles that you see in childhood bullies are very like those of the perpetrators of genocide. In fact, she says it is a short walk from bullying to hate crimes to genocide. It is not a giant leap. Her book is titled Extraordinary Evil, A Short Walk to Genocide. It is published by Nation Books, and it is out now in the bookstores. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be as brief as they can, and we ask that so we can get in as many different callers as possible and keep the program moving along. But anyone's welcome to join the conversation. If you are in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. And whether you're listening around Illinois and Indiana over the air, or you're listening on the Internet, if you're in the United States, that number will work for you. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455. That's the local number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Ms. Colarosa, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
We appreciate it. You have had an experience that perhaps few people have, in the sense that you were able to observe directly the after effects of a recent case of genocide. This was when you were in Rwanda.
Yes, I work in
a couple
Rwanda.
Years ago.
Well, I actually work in Rwanda on a regular basis.
Ah, okay.
With orphans from the genocide and of 94, where almost a million human beings were slaughtered in less than 3 months, and the international community looked on.
And this, although I know that that was a case where you found yourself as you saw what the damage that resulted, you asked this question, well, why did this happen? How could this happen? I guess that really, though, wasn't the first time where you had asked yourself that question.
No, actually, and as you mentioned in the intro, I work in parenting and teaching, but I was on a plane trip from LAX to New York in the late 70s, and in those days, you could throw a book into a bin at an airport and pick a book out, and I needed something to read. And I picked a very slim book out. I thought, oh, I can get this read. It was Elie Wiesel's Night. And by the time I landed in New York, I was visibly shaken. And I could not believe, with a master's degree plus, and having been a former Franciscan nun with a major in theology and a minor in philosophy, that I had missed this. And I actually went back to my old history books from high school and thought, I must have slept. I can't believe I would have missed a genocide in World War II. And indeed, it was not even in our history books. I'm 60. I graduated in 65 from high school. And even going through university, had missed it totally. And so my interest was piqued in how ordinary human beings could gather together and kill huge numbers of other human beings and go home to dinner, as if it had not happened, or as if it was part of work, or they were obeying orders. And so my interest was piqued, and as I traveled around the world lecturing on parenting and school issues, I would stop if I was in Germany or Poland or Australia. I walked the rabbit-proof fence there. I worked in South America with some of the people who had their families disappeared, quote-unquote, in Argentina and Guatemala. And then when I got involved in Rwanda with orphans from that genocide, I had just completed my bully book, The Bully, the Bullied, and the Bystander. And one of the young people I was working with who had lost his entire family and witnessed the macheting death of his family, and himself had four machete cuts to the head, asked me if I would speak to a university professor who in turn asked me if I would speak to new teachers at the University of Rwanda in Butare. And they wanted me to talk on schoolyard bullying. And I said, oh, sure. This is a place on campus where 11 years before, half the staff had killed the other half, and half the students had participated in the death of their Tutsi classmates. And you'd like me to talk on schoolyard bullying. I said, I will do it if you will let me demonstrate to them that it is literally a short walk from schoolyard bullying to hate crimes to genocide. That genocide is not an unimaginable horror, as many, many people look at it. Every genocide throughout human history has been thoroughly imagined, meticulously planned, and brutally executed. And that did not begin with the machete cuts of the Hutu power or the gas chambers of the Nazis or the death marches of the Young Turks in the Ottoman Empire. It began with contempt for another human being. And I see genocide as the most extreme form of bullying, which is a far too common system of behaviors that's learned in childhood, where we are able to put another human being outside our circle of moral concern. They are no longer, as Martin Buber said, an I and a thou, both of us very unique with a common humanity. But I, in essence, when I bully you, I make you an it. And to me, that is step one in a genocide. You have to be able to see that other human being as less than human. And if you recall, the Tutsis were called cockroaches. Mm-hmm. Actually, from the time they were very young, they understood that they were either snakes or cockroaches themselves, because that's what they were called. In Nazi Germany, they did not kill Jews. They killed vermin and bacilli, eating at the fabric of our society. And it is in the minds of people that these persons are it. And as I work throughout the world, the issue of bullying, people will say, well, schoolyard bullying. We're not just talking a verbal taunt at a person. I'm here in Victoria, British Columbia today, and yesterday, it was 10 years ago, that a group of young people cheered on some young girls as they broke Renee Virk's arms and drowned her at 14. And so we had all three characters, the bully, the bullied, and the bystanders.
Hmm. Well, I tell you what, we have a caller here who's waiting patiently to join the conversation, and I will not wait, make that person wait any longer because they were with us virtually right from the start. Let's bring them in, and also for the benefit of anyone else who might just have tuned in, I want to introduce again our guest, Barbara Coloroso. She's an internationally recognized speaker and author who deals in her work with things like parenting and school discipline and nonviolent conflict resolution. And as she mentioned, she's particularly known for writing about and talking about bullying. She is the author of a newly published book that is about genocide. The title is Extraordinary Evil, A Short Walk to Genocide. It's published by Nation Books, in which, as she said, she really makes this argument that if you take a look at the behavior patterns, the behavior cycles of childhood bullies, they look very much like those of the perpetrators of genocide. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller, someone listening in Chicago, and so let's bring them in. Line number four. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask your guest two questions. One, do you think that violent video games desensitize people toward these genocides?
Yes, I do. Actually, the book that preceded this Extraordinary Evil is not available in the United States. It's been published in Canada. It's called Just Because It's Not Wrong Doesn't Make It Right, Teaching Kids to Think and Act Ethically. And it was actually my first book that I thoroughly explored the connections on media violence and the impact it has on young people. And one of the things it does do is desensitize children to real-life violence. It also can numb them to the normal, natural responses that we have when another person is hurt is called empathic distress, and that can be numbed in children who are regularly exposed to violence.
And, you know, I read quite a bit myself, and I don't know if you know it or not, but the Nuremberg laws that Hitler put in place in 1935 were eerily similar to the Jim Crow laws that we had in the United States at that time.
Absolutely, and I do make the comparison with the Nuremberg laws and the Hutu Ten Commandments. It was actually a template for many of these kinds of laws. And if you notice in every one of them, step one is excluding the other human being from humanity, so to speak, making them an it.
Yeah, just
yet
one more thing.
They became its.
Yeah, just one more thing, and then I'll get out of your way. I'm unfamiliar with the Renee Burke case that you mentioned. Could you explain that for those of us who don't know?
Yes, Renee Burke was a 14-year-old girl here in Victoria, and when a group of girls invited her to a little party, they beat her up. And a group of 25 other, quote-unquote, normal kids, and these were the bystanders, cheered on the girls. And then a girl and a friend of hers brought the Renee Burke, badly beaten, and the others left, badly beaten to a river and under a bridge. They held her down, broke her arms, and drowned her.
Now, was this in Africa?
No, no. This was right here in Victoria, British Columbia.
Well, were any of
right across the border.
Were any of those people ever punished?
Yes, two of them were. But the bystanders have had to live with what they witnessed and failed to stop.
It's hard to believe that would happen in a civilized country, but then Germany was civilized. And
well, absolutely. And, again, most of my work is in bullying, and I give examples of young people who have either killed themselves or been killed in the thing called bullying, go on to develop contempt for other human beings and take out other human beings in school shootings.
Well, you know, it's interesting that I always thought it was interesting that while President Roosevelt was talking about the Four Freedoms, he was locking up Japanese Americans behind barbed wire.
And we all have to address that as part of our history, how we can dehumanize another human being and put them outside our circle of moral concern, because I do believe that when we begin to do this, it is step one of the path toward being able to destroy an entire group of human beings.
I think so. I think when you look at this woman in Alabama who refused to get up and give her seat to a white guy and nearly got killed for it, she got death threats and had to leave the state, I think it's hard to realize that not all that this thing can happen in America or Canada or British Columbia, but it can.
It can happen any place.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You know, I think you, it's probably worth talking a little bit more about this basic, the kind of complex web of individuals and the different parts they play in bullying. And I think we must have talked about this before that on the show. I have this feeling that we did. And that people need to understand that in a case of bullying, or then when you take it to this other step, it is there's more than the bully and the bullied, that it's very important that there are other people who they may in fact not be directly involved, but they're enablers in various ways.
Well, there are three characters, and they are important characters. You're right. They're not just the bully and the bully. There are the bystanders. There could not be a genocide without a Talat or a Hitler or Hutu power, the bullies or the genocidaires. But equally, they could not have pulled it off without the complicity of bystanders. And author William Burroughs, the English author, said it so profoundly. He said, there are no innocent bystanders. What were they doing there in the first place? And in my bullying work and in the genocide work, there are similar characters. You have the bully, and then you have the target in the middle. Below the bully, you have the bully's henchmen. Now, these are kids in a bullying scenario that we did not raise to be bullies, but we raised them to do to please. And they did to please us in the younger years. But in middle school, when that high-status social bully says, we're not going to like the new girl, and if you would like to be a part of my group, you won't like her either. And the henchman goes along with that because she wants to fit in, and she will even do despicable things in order to fit into the crowd. But she's learned to do to please, and that's why as parents And as communities, as educators, it's so critical that we teach young people to question authority, to know how to think, not just what to think, because henchmen play a vital role in both bullying and genocide. Then you have the active supporters. Those are the kids who cheer the bully on, and seek to reap the social or economic and political success in a genocide. Then you have the passive supporters, and those are the young people who get pleasure from somebody else's pain. They don't participate in the bullying, but they are the ones you can hear saying, ha ha ha, do you know what those girls did to the new girl? Or ha ha ha, do you know what those boys did to the new boy in the locker room? Again, they're getting pleasure from somebody else's pain, which is one of the characteristics of bullying. That is a conscious, willful, deliberate, hostile activity intended to harm, where you get that pleasure from somebody else's pain. Then at the very bottom of the circle, you have a deadly lot, which, by the way, can be you and me as adults in a schoolyard bullying scenario, but is also you and me in the international community, the disengaged onlookers, when we turn a blind eye and say, oh, it's boys will be boys, girls just want to be mean. And on the international scene, we say, well, what interest do we have in those people in Rwanda? I mean, there's no oil there. There's human beings being slaughtered. But, you know, these are people that have been fighting forever. Those are the excuses we give as disengaged onlookers. On the upswing of the circle, we see potential witnesses. And in bullying, those are the kids, as parents and educators, that we raise to act with integrity and civility and compassion. But they're afraid of the bully. They're afraid if they step in, they'll be next. They're afraid if they step in, that it'll make it worse for the target. Or they're just simply fearful. Those are the and. Arthur Eddington, the mathematician, said, we used to think if we knew one, we knew two. Because one and one equals two. What we're beginning to realize is that we must learn a great deal about and. And that's where in the schoolyard, you and I have to recognize that when you put a group of kids together with a bully as the leader, they will often do things that they would never do alone because they get locked into what is called the trap of comradeship, where they begin to feed on one another. And when the caller before mentioned deadly video games or violent video games, I am concerned about that violence. But, you know, I'm also concerned about the humor kids are exposed to because they are learning today, as never before, to laugh at other human beings' pain. Bill Cosby said it so beautifully, I do miss the days when comedy wasn't mean, when it wasn't at the expense of another human being. And when you put a group together and they start laughing at being horribly ugly, whether it's verbal or physical or relational bullying to another human being, they themselves are creating a monster, a collective group of people that will break a young girl's arm and drown her.
Hmm. Well, let's talk with another caller. We have someone in Urbana. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi. Another thing we need to keep in mind is that when we don't speak up against bullying. And I'm thinking as an example right now of anti-gay activity, mm-hmm. that we allow it, we give it more status and allow it to be used as a weapon in addition to being used against gays, but to bully people who are not gay into behaving in ways that they shouldn't. A woman who refuses unwanted advances may be targeted as being a lesbian because she doesn't want to respond to a particular male. A guy may be teased and targeted, even if he's not gay, about the way he dresses or acts. There are a lot of people who are in the closet, and you wouldn't have any idea that they were lesbian or gay, according to the stereotypes that some people have, and other people who are not gay who do have some of those characteristics, whatever they happen to be. And I think this is particularly important when we're talking about teenagers who are still trying to develop strategies for pushing aside and not being bothered by those kinds of things. And I would also say that I think we have to speak out when a predominant religion is used to bully people. Christianity has been used this way against Native Americans because they weren't Christian. They were savages, therefore less than human. They weren't going to be saved, so they it didn't matter how you treated them in some cases. And I was just watching the program about Darwin the other night, Darwin on trial, along with Intelligent Design, and the folks who were who brought the suit to prevent Intelligent Design from being the taught in their school in Dover received hate mail. Now, I'm sure that there are people who are on the other side who may use hate mail, but people got death threats because, even people who were Christians were targeted as being, quote, atheists. Atheists, to some people in our culture, are seen as immoral, ungodly, never going to heaven, therefore less than. When I look at the far radical right, the skinheads and so forth, you hear them talking about blacks as mudbloods and having rejected Christ. You talk about Jews as being the people who foment hate, talk about them as Christ killers. It's all with regard, it's religion is used to bully people. And I think we need to stand up against that because these folks are going to come after it. Not only is it not right, but it also spreads to the rest of the culture.
You brought up so many good points here. You're absolutely right on the three characters and how if we are silent, if we are those disengaged or potential witnesses afraid to stand up, it will not stop. Just as Arthur Eddington said, there's the and. There is also the or. At the very top of the bully circle is the antithesis of the bully. That's the witness, resist, offender. Those are the people who stood up and spoke out and defended people who were being ripped apart. They defended other human beings, and they gave witness by reporting it, writing, and rescuing people. In every genocide, there were witnesses, resistors, and defenders. But the majority of the people fell into the trap of being the bully or the bullies, bystanders that were supporters for them. And if you look at hate crimes, that's why I say that intermediate step, that there is the bullying, schoolyard bullying, then there's hate crimes, and then genocide. There are the race, religion, gender, physical, and mental ability are the big five for hate crimes. What makes a hate crime different than any other kind of crime? It's criminal bullying. It is rooted in contempt for another human being. And when we allow in our schools for kids to call one another gross terms that are either racial or religious or sexual, and by the way, the majority of bullying that goes on in middle school and high school is sexual in nature. That's a time in their lives when they're developing their own sexual identity and they're coming to grips with their strong emotions. So what is a good way to target somebody? To call them a gross sexual term, to demean them, to make them an it. We had in Wyoming Matthew Shepard, who was beaten up and hung on a fence post to die. And when the two young men were arrested, they very casually said, yeah, but he was gay. Black man in Jasper, Texas, dragged in the back of a pickup when the people that were killed him were arrested. They said, yeah, but he was black. The young girl I spoke about at the very beginning, Renee Virk, when her perpetrators were arrested, they said, yeah, but she was brown and ugly and fat, and we didn't like her. As if that justified dehumanizing another human being. So if we don't speak up, who will? And religion, I'm a former Franciscan nun, obviously former with a husband and three kids, and religion was complicit in the genocide in Rwanda. That country was 94% Christian, of that 65% Catholic, and in 100 days, almost 1 million human beings were killed. And all of the faith traditions that were there had somebody complicit in the genocide, from archbishops down. So these are issues. Religion can be used as a weapon or as a vessel for spirituality. It can be used as a sword or a plowshare. And it's really how it's used that can make the difference.
Well, again, we're a little bit past the midpoint here. I want to thank the last caller. We have another one who is waiting, and I do again want to introduce our guest, Barbara Colarosa. She is internationally recognized as a speaker and author in a number of areas, including parenting and school discipline, nonviolent conflict resolution, and as we have mentioned, she has written a lot about bullying. Her new book is about genocide. The title is Extraordinary Evil, A Short Walk to Genocide, published by Nation Books, and in which she makes this argument that if you take a look at the behavior cycles of childhood bullies, they look very like those of perpetrators of genocide. In fact, as the subtitle would suggest, she says, it's not a long trip from bullying to hate crimes to genocide. It's not a giant leap. It is, in fact, a short walk. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And let's talk again with another caller. And this is also someone in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Oh, yeah. Hi, how are you? Very timely subject. My problem with, I guess I'm sort of a cynic about this whole subject because seems that I'm 57 now, and I was in the military when I was 19 through 21 in Southeast Asia, and so I've sort of seen the other side of this story. But the point is that there's a film John Sayles did a few years back called Men with Guns, which is very interesting. This subject's not about genocide per se, but it's about how authority is in these third world or lesser developed countries. And you were speaking about Rwanda and how, like, one half of the population tried to kill the other half or more or less succeeded in killing a million people. And I do agree with your thesis that it does start at the individual, but it is interesting how it develops and rolls into the collective, such in Germany, Daniel Goldhagen's book, Hitler's Willing Executioners, is a good example of that also. But I'm just curious as to use the term dehumanize. So you would have to say the opposite of that is humanity. Humanize is good. So I'm not quite sure. This is about the nature of mankind. I mean, are they intrinsically good or are they just animals? I mean, I would almost say when I was in the military 38 years ago, I wasn't exactly kind to people. You know what I mean?
I do, and actually that is the what you're bringing up here is that trap of comradeship, that you as an individual, your humanity is intact, you care deeply about other human beings, and often would be stressed that you would have to, under orders, commit some awful acts. We're seeing this with our young soldiers coming home today, and the like, and that's why war has to be examined. And what is a just war? However, when you look at, and by the way, every genocide often uses as a cover a war, and the pretext that we're in a conflict, and there indeed may be a conflict. I mean, the Allies did not go over to stop Hitler from killing the Jews. That was not the goal. It was to stop Hitler from invading other countries. If they'd have been intent on dealing with the extermination of human beings that Hitler was doing, they would have bombed the train tracks. So there is that mask of war that is often used. But you're also very right. You know, the whole thing about obedience to authority, Herbert Kelman, who survived the death camps, talked about three kinds of obedience. There's the rule-based, the role-based, and the value-oriented obedience. And the rule base means it's a rule, I was told to do it, and I did it. And some people will say, I was only doing what I was told to do. Others, the role base would be people like Eichmann, who made those trains run on time. He was so proud that he made the trains run on time. And even in his trials, he said, proudly talking about his medals, he said, and you know what, I met every quota every day. And the quota, as he spoke about it, these were human beings he sent to death camps. And so there's that role-based obedience that you do it because what am I going to get in for this? And then there is the value-oriented obedience that we must teach all of our young people. All soldiers are taught that if there is an unlawful order, if you are told to do something that is against the law, even by a commanding officer, that you can disobey it. The young man who reported the abuse at Abu Ghraib struggled with that because of his comradeship with his group, but he also knew that it violated not only the Geneva Convention, but what we are to do with human beings. And so I want to raise a group of young people who will have value-oriented obedience, that they will obey the laws because they are just laws. And if they are unjust laws, as Martin Luther King stood up to the unjust laws in the South, that they are willing to stand up against those laws and take the consequences for it.
Yeah. On the notion of just war, you were talking about Augustine's idea.
Yeah.
Augustine actually basically also wrote the thesis, the idea, the concept of original sin. Well, we're all guilty from the beginning, and unless you're saved by Jesus, whatever, until you're saved, you're guilty from day one. So, I mean, everybody sort of discarded that because, you know, the Garden of Eden is obviously a myth. But I'm just quite, I mean, I've heard this a lot. There were a couple gentlemen earlier this year here doing a religious conference on religion in combat and, you know, the use of religion as a justification, as you earlier said, or an excuse. I call it an excuse.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah. And, but because of your background, I would see that would be very apt. But, it's just a very interesting question to me because it's like whenever you set someone up when I was drafted, they, you know, you just, it was an authority. I mean, it compounded it into you. They literally beat it into you that do what we tell you to do or, you know, we'll shoot you, more or less, or we'll put you in jail for the rest of your life, that kind of threat. And so the comradeship is partly you're all in it together and also the fact of fear. And also I wanted to ask something else. I want to say I have this thesis that Hitlers, the Hitlers of the world, basically give everybody permission to do things. Sort of like, you know, the towers were hit by the planes, and Bush came on and said, you know, we're at war, and so he gave everybody permission, and everybody goes, okay, we can do it. So you turn off your reasoning. But thank you very much. I really appreciate your work. I hope you're right. I hope you work. I hope it works. But I'm just very cynical about it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And I think we need to, I personally believe there's no inherent human nature that requires us to kill or maim. And that we have the potential for precisely the behavior that the Nazis and the Hutu power and the Talibs had. But we also have the kind of more altruistic or cooperative behavior. We can go either way. And I think by confronting genocide, which many people might say, oh, look, we don't have to deal with that in our country. But by confronting it, we can then say, okay, what can I do today in my community? How do I treat hired help? How do I treat somebody walking through the grocery store who's moving a little slower than I'd like them to? How do I treat somebody who is different than I am? Because I'm teaching my children all the time just by my actions. When somebody at a family gathering tells a racist or sexist joke, can my children see me saying to them, I'm bothered by that? Even when all the relatives roll their eyes and say, what, can't you take a joke? Not that kind. And you know you've had an impact when you walk back into the dining room and everybody in the family shuts up. But you know you've had an impact because you have said that I don't want to dehumanize another human being. I'm very concerned with some of the rhetoric we hear today about people who are undocumented workers. We had a well-known person in my own state refer to people who did not have proper documentation as illegals, are vermin and bacteria eating at the fabric of our society, which is almost an identical quote from Hitler, what he called Jews. So we have to be very cautious today in our own country that we are not unquestioningly obedient to authority, that in a democracy we truly challenge, that we have a value-oriented obedience, that I'm willing to obey the laws. I will follow the two yellow lines down the road because I trust that you will too, and we can get along with one another if we do that. But if an ambulance comes down the road, we both pull over and let the ambulance through. We don't say he violated the law or he was speeding. We wish him Godspeed and so glad it's not us. There is a time that we have to stand up and speak out against an unjust law.
Yeah. Well, I think that here we keep coming back to what I think is a key idea here is people understand the kind of cast of characters that you've described. And whether we're talking about a schoolyard bully or whether we're talking about something like mass murder, that our one of our target populations here, the place that we maybe are most concerned is, yes, we're concerned with the people who do the bullying, but a big concern is this very large group of people who say, who turn away and say, well, this really doesn't have anything to do with me.
You know, the disengaged onlookers. Yeah,
yeah. That's the, and the key, you know, the key, as you explained it, the key is the people, you know, can you get some person or persons to say, no, this is wrong. I'm not going to participate in this. You shouldn't be doing this. This is just, you know, the people that stand up and say, no, this is wrong. You shouldn't be doing that. So, how it is that you encourage that kind of spirit in, I guess what we're talking about really is our children. Ultimately, how you encourage that kind of spirit in them.
Raising young people who can think and act ethically. And it doesn't begin with thinking. It doesn't begin with acting. It begins with a deep caring. I tell children, you do not have to like every kid in your classroom, but you must honor their humanity. And as the one woman caller mentioned, you know, you often will be shot down yourself. People will verbally abuse you, send you death threats. If you try to stand up for a value, or for another human being, it is not easy. And I don't pretend in the schoolyard, in the lunchroom, in middle school, when all the other girls say, we're not going to eat with a new girl, it is not easy for your son or daughter to stand up and say, that's mean and cruel, and go over and sit next to the new girl, when your daughter will probably get, oh, Miss Goody Two-Shoes, or you're next, or when your son's friends say, look at that person over there, different skin color, religion, gender, physical or mental ability, big five again, let's go mess him up. I want your son to be able to say no, even when the burden is very heavy, when his peers say, what are you, chicken? What are you, just like him? No. But one of the heartening things for me is as I began to study witnesses and resistors and defenders and met with them, I also met a group of people who said, I wouldn't have done it. I wouldn't have rescued people. I wouldn't have stood up had somebody else not done it first. So that trap of comradeship that bullies get all the bystanders to join into, there is also our common humanity that witnesses and resistors and defenders speak up about. And there are people who said, had he not asked me, I wouldn't have rescued anybody. But once I started doing it, they themselves got very creative about how they rescued people and did it on their own. So we need leaders in our communities, in our schoolyards, and in our politics who are willing to say, no more, not here, never will we dehumanize another human being. We got to watch our language because verbal bullying is the first most common form of bullying, where we dehumanize through words, and then we go into relational bullying where we shun them and ostracize them from us, and then comes the physical.
We have about 10 minutes left in this hour. Just again, real quickly, introducing the guest, Barbara Coloroso. She has written and spoken a lot on things like parenting and teaching, school discipline, nonviolent conflict resolution, and is well known for writing about and talking about bullying. Her new book is Extraordinary Evil, A Short Walk to Genocide, published by Nation Books, and in which she, as I have said, makes this argument that when you take a look at the kinds of behavior patterns you see in childhood bullies, she says they're really not that much different from those of the perpetrators of genocide. So you might want to take a look at the book. It's out in the bookstore now. Questions, welcome to. Here we have a couple of people who are ready to go. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And let's talk next with someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Well, I just woke up. And I turned on the radio, and I heard you say something about genocide, that we don't have to worry about that here in this country. And I'm wondering, were you born and raised in the United States?
Oh, I was saying that's how we feel. That's not true, though.
Yeah.
Oh, we must worry about it happening here, and it has happened, and I mentioned
I just wanted to mention that we live here in this nice area where, there, when you drive up and down Highway 1 in eastern Illinois, you pass a lot of historical markers and this and that. And when you go and look at what it's all about, you discover that General Clark and General Wayne were turned loose in this area to expunge the Native Americans. And it made the story that's told makes it look kind of like Bosnia. I mean, people were murdered and killed and run out just because they were not white people, you know.
Well, actually, in Rwanda, which is where I spend a lot of time working with orphans from the genocide, there is actually a poster, and I mentioned it in my book, where they list the various genocides throughout history, and at the very top is the genocide of First Nation peoples in North America. And so I was saying, and as you just tuned in to that, that we often think, oh, it can't happen here, and indeed it has, and it can happen again.
Yeah, it already did. And, yeah, I just wanted to gently remind people that we can't be sitting on our high horse because we're standing amidst the bones and the blood of it right here. So.
And none of us can stand on a high horse if we've been any of those characters, if we've been the bystanders or the bullies. It's the resistors and witnesses and defenders that are going to turn this around. They can be wonderful role models for us. And people whose obedience is based on value orientation don't merely obey. They take an active role in formulating and evaluating and questioning the politics of the state. We have to be active in a democracy to ever keep this from happening again, or we will fall into the trap of fascism. And if anyone would have suggested that in the 30s in Nazi Germany, before it became a Nazi state, people would have said, oh, never. It's possible anyplace. The genocide of the Rwandans, the Tutsis, happened in 100 days. It had, there were six scenes in this tragedy, as there are in all bullying scenarios. The stage was set, and we could have stopped it early. And I think one of the main reasons I wrote this book, other than connecting it to bullying, was that we as an international community cannot continue to use conflict resolution tools to deal with a genocide. And we made that mistake in Rwanda when Romeo Dallaire was told by his superiors that he was to remain neutral and impartial and at the consent of both parties. And we can do that when two kids are fighting over a TV program. We can do that when two states are warring. We cannot do that when another kid is dehumanizing a classmate or if a group of human beings are set to exterminate another group of human beings. We have to look at alternative tools for actually stopping a genocide, not remaining neutral or impartial or at the consent of both parties. And I fear we're seeing that in Darfur, where we're going to send peacekeepers in but not allow them to seize weapons, which is what you do in a conflict. It's not what you do in a genocide.
All right, let's talk with someone else. Line two, this is also Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Yeah, I'm wondering if all the genocides are caused by the bullies. I mean, it seems like in this country anyway that an awful lot of serial murderers are, in fact, the bullied. So I guess I'm wondering whether genocide is from the people who were once oppressed ever, or is it always...
Oh, you bring up an important point. There is one character, there are seven kinds of bullies. One is a high social status bully I talked about with the young girl. But there are, and I do work in school shootings, and I'm from Littleton, Colorado, and we had our shooting at Columbine. There are characters called bullied bullies, and they're the most dangerous. You ask high school kids who they're most afraid of. It is not a bully. It is the kid who can't take it anymore, who not only demeans himself, but develops that anger into contempt for himself and for others and is willing to take out other human beings. So there is that character, and there are people in Santa California, a young boy who had been horribly targeted since kindergarten. His brother said since grade school, kids pulled at his ears till they bled. They dunked him in the toilet. They videotaped humiliating him. And in high school, he said, I'm going to get them. He's in jail. He killed two people. He injured 13. But he was horribly humiliated up to that point. We recognize that battered women often will strike back. We have failed to recognize that young people who have to be in school, who are relentlessly tormented, sometimes strike back. Not that it justifies what they did. I will never justify that. But we need to take a look, a very careful look, at the culture of mean that may have been created there where young people who are killing themselves or striking back have been in such humiliating situations themselves. In terms of the genocidaires, there definitely would have been some who could have been classified as bullied bullies. There were others who just had a strong sense of contempt and felt very righteous in what they did. And so there are those who have been horribly hurt, but there are also others who say, well, I was raised to believe that these people are no good, and killing them is getting rid of cockroaches as far as I'm concerned. So it's a mix, and so I don't classify them. There are seven kinds of bullies, and to look at just the bullied bully would be a mistake.
And again, another caller here on our toll-free line in Morris. This is line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of agree, but I disagree. If there was oil in Darfur, I think we'd be there. But because there's no monetary value, nobody in the United States gives a hoot, unfortunately. I agree with what you say, but talk is cheap. Talk has never solved any problems, as far as I'm concerned. As a United States taxpayer citizen, I look at what we waste all our money on, and this should be something we should take care of. Unfortunately, the modern time shows we have to have some justification for blowing up all this expensive military equipment that we have to prove its worth. And it's a sad fact that places like Darfur and Sudan and, you know, even Bosnia-Herzegovina is up in arms again. We keep losing the fact that we have humans losing their lives more every day by the thousands, and nobody cares. And I want to comment on one other thing, too, the bully thing. I one time was bullied like you were explaining, but I came out okay. And because I had intervention with people, it basically shows that there is a humankind. Nowadays, I don't see that in any of the kids, any of the schools. There's lack of the family union. So you're talking about bully. I think it's a little bit, I don't think that's a right analogy of it. I think basically it's just, you know, one head of state over another head of state wanting to take, you know, something that they say monetary. That's the only reason why they're there.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more on the disengaged onlookers, that we are turning a blind eye. We did it in Rwanda. And one of the comments from a State Department official is we have no interest there. Other than many of us who were yelling and screaming at that point were saying, yes, these are human interests, just as you said. And the bully, just because you targeted doesn't mean you turn into a bully. Those are choices that can happen. And I would say you're talking about humanity. Most kids who are targeted are very caring, sensitive human beings, as you were. And so you are concerned about other people's humanity. And I won't say the fact that you were targeted made you more sensitive. You were sensitive to begin with. You were caring and compassionate, as most targeted kids are. And some people turn that into utter contempt. Others go on with their lives and make sure it never happens to another human being. And I've seen that over and over again with young people who were targeted and said, I'm going to stand up for other people so nobody has to live through what I lived through. But I think your point is well taken there, that we can no longer afford to be disengaged onlookers. And yes, there is oil in Darfur. It's just that the Chinese were there, and they're getting it. And they are turning a blind eye as well. We are rattling and talking a lot and saying it's a genocide. But once you say it's a genocide, I believe we have a moral obligation to act. And I'm seeing that lack of will here. Although I must say one of the strongest Darfur movements is actually in our own country, trying to stop it in any way possible. So the human masses are collecting to say no more, not here, never. We just have to get the political will to do it.
Certainly there are many documented cases, a number of documented cases of genocide in the 20th century, beginning with the Armenian genocide, and certainly genocides going back into the past. As
oh, yes.
One of the caller made, there are people who would make the argument that genocide took place here in the Americas against the indigenous people. Why is it, though, it seems that every time this happens, we act as if this has never happened before?
Well, I call it the gorilla in our midst. It's sustained inattentional blindness for dynamic events, which was a research project, long title. But it's where we fail to see what's going on. For instance, I'll give you the Rwandan example. The peacekeepers were sent in. There was a group fighting against another group, trying to get back into the country with a long history there. But when a young man came to Romeo Dallaire, who was the head of the peacekeeping troop, and said, "These are where the weapons are hidden. This is the list of people that will be slaughtered first," he wrote to his superiors and asked if he could seize the weapons, and he was told to remain neutral, impartial, and to consent of both parties. And what I see happening in the schoolyard, and as I began to do the research on the first book, the bully book, what alarmed me is that the majority of anti-bullying programs in our own country had as their foundation conflict resolution. So if we see everything as a nail and all we have is a hammer, that's the way we view things, that this is a conflict, this is how we have to resolve it, or we'll let somebody else, let them figure it out themselves. But it's like two kids fighting over a TV program. That's where I remain neutral, impartial, and the consent of both parties. I get them to figure it out themselves and help them learn to solve their conflicts nonviolently. However, if the 10-year-old has the 5-year-old's arm up the back and the kid's screaming at the top of his lungs, I rush in there, and as soon as the 10-year-old sees me, she drops her brother's arm, starts comforting him. I need to see it for what it really is, that this is an attack on an individual. This is not a two-sided affair. And we need to deal with those things very differently. So that means we have to open our eyes to see eliminist campaigns where we are trying to destroy an entire group of people. And I would say in our own country, we have to watch the rhetoric when it comes to people who are undocumented, because that is where I'm beginning to see some real hate. I also see it, as the one woman said, with people with their gender orientation being attacked. No one should ever be attacked because we've said that they're an it. Yeah.
We're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say we're just here at the end of the time. For people who would like to read more on the subject, to look for the book we've mentioned, Extraordinary Evil, A Short Walk to Genocide, published by Nation Books, by our guest Barbara Coloroso. Also, you might be interested in looking at her book on bullying, which is still available in paper. That's The Bully, The Bullied, and The Bystander, From Preschool to High School, How Parents and Teachers Can Help Break the Cycle of Violence. And Ms. Coloroso, thanks very much.
Oh, and thank you. And I believe we can do it. I think we can be those witnesses and resistors and defenders.